Welcome to the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley, psychology student and international best-selling psychology author of over 30 psychology books, bringing you the latest psychology news, fascinating psychology topics and more each week. If you want to learn more, then please check out connorwhiteley.net/books. And don't forget to like and subscribe to the YouTube video or follow on your favourite podcast app. And here's the show. Hi everyone, and welcome to episode 259 of the Psychology World podcast with me, Connor Whiteley. And today's episode is on what are the key elements of a formulation report? And it is Saturday, the 30th of March, 2024, as I record this. So the reason why I wanted to do today's podcast episode is because formulation in psychotherapy and in clinical psychology is really a popular topic because, thankfully, it's becoming more and more important to clinical psychology is thankfully moving away from diagnosis and more towards formulation. And to be honest, I just love formulation because this is basically where you tailor make a psychotherapy to better suit a client's unique circumstances, situation, and their presenting mental health difficulties. So I love formulation. I will always be a fan of it, and it turns out that you guys like it too. Because in 2023, the formulation-based podcast episode was surprisingly, I only have one podcast episode out of all 250 plus of them based on a formulation. So that podcast episode got 592% more views compared to other podcast episodes. So I'm really happy. And this is why I want to start doing more formulation stuff in the future. But to be honest, granted it's taken me 3 months to do one episode, I probably won't end up doing it that much. But I love it. This is a really useful episode that I know you're going to enjoy. So moving on to the psychology news section, we're reading from the British Psychological Society Research Digest. And the first one is just weird. It is just weird, and I think most of these are going to be weird today, but it just makes them even more fun. So the first one is, chimps and bees may also perform uniquely human behaviour. Comparative psychologists are abuzz with excitement as bees and chimpanzees show evidence of a capacity previously thought to be exclusive to humans. Every day we benefit from accomplishments and inventions that are far too complicated for any single person to have developed from scratch. Evidence of this so-called accumulative cultural evolution is everywhere, from the cars on our roads to the TVs in our homes. Our ability to learn from other people is key to this, and it's been argued that such social learning is unique to humans. However, two recent studies provide strong evidence that other species can in fact learn complex, helpful behaviours from others that they wouldn't have been able to develop on their own. And then if you want to read more about the Pacific studies, then you can head on over to the BPS Research Digest website though. So I think that this is definitely quite an interesting one, simply because social learning, massive fan of it, and to be honest, like, without it we simply couldn't do anything for ourselves, because I mean, like, no one is that intelligent that they know all the answers themselves. So, because if you actually look into the different stages and how TVs, or to be honest, like, even cameras, to be honest, and basically anything in the world as you like those over time, then you can see that there's tons of like different people. Even the light bulb is sadly misaccredited to Thomas Edison because he drew on the work of like quite a few other like scientists. Even something as basic as the light bulb wasn't actually done by a single person. So social learning and learning from other people is absolutely a critical though. So something that I think would be an interesting next step is, so now we know that our close relatives, like chimpanzees, are capable of it, it'd be interesting to see, is there a evolutionary basis for it? Which there probably is, because this is a similarity throughout all human societies. So the second one is, dogs seem to catch even small shifts in our mannerisms. New research suggests that pooches may be as in tune with our emotions as owners hope. Any dog owner will tell you that dogs can read up what you're feeling, arrive home in a joyful mood, and they're likely to get an even happier dog welcoming you back. Come home feeling angry, the response could be very different. But new work in the Journal of Comparative Psychology shows that dogs are sensitive to even subtle changes in our demeanour. Using the method of still faces studies, which were first used to probe emotional understanding between mothers and babies, the team observes that dogs appear to behave with similar discomfort to human infants when their owners share them a blank egg aspersion. Whilst it's attempting to say "ah" and walk away with the impression that their dogs react to our small, perhaps a bit stranger shifts in mood, such as like babies, it's somewhat tricky to draw that line. Okay, so this I think is quite a funny one, because I mean, if you've ever gone on YouTube, to be honest, and just look at still face studies, they're some of the most heartbreaking psychology studies ever, because you see a really nice thing about a mother and a baby playing together, then the mother's face changes, and for 2 minutes basically the mother has such a blank expression and the baby sort of like what the hell for the first bit, and then they start crying, they get really distressed, they get so upset, and then the mother can't do anything for those 2 minutes, so it's really hard on the baby. But I mean, I can't imagine what it's like for those mothers just seeing your baby crying so upset for those 2 minutes, because you can't do anything for the sake of the egg experiment. So definitely some of the most heartbreaking psychology studies out there. But I also think that it's a really nice idea though, but dogs do behave like babies when it comes to the still face egg experiment. And I guess that it's quite interesting to see, yeah, that dogs are capable of a larger range of emotions than maybe previously thought. I mean, I'm not a dog owner, so I can't really talk too much about this, but it's interesting. And besides that, I don't think there's too much I can comment on, simply because my experience of dogs is rather limited. So the last one is, and this is everyone's favourite, of course, treating your fear of spiders could fix your fear of heights. These don't typically come in isolation. If you're scared of one thing, research suggests you're more likely to be scared of other things too. Sometimes those are fears that share characteristics or categories, like a fear of spiders extending to the fear of insects. This phenomenon is sometimes referred to as fear generalization. When we have multiple fears, however, that aren't always similar, phobias can spread across many different things that seem to have no real connection. Many of these can be improved by egg aspersion therapy, a treatment which allows people to confront individual specific phobias in manageable stages. But could egg aspersion therapy behave similarly to fear generalization, easing our nerves across multiple unrelated phobias? Writing in Translational Psychiatry, Iris Trojogan and her colleagues find evidence that this may indeed be the case. Okay, so this I think is a fascinating one, because I was also working a outreach event at a school here in Medway, or when on like a Monday, and I was talking to a fellow psychology student He was very scared of like a spider's there, which I thought was actually quite weird though, because the reason why the conversation popped up, it actually wasn't Monday, it was Saturday as an applicant day, is because at the university there's a lab that has a live tarantula in though, and one of the lecturer brings in their kids at times to help feed it. I feel it though, which I think is interesting, and those kids are brave. And I'm not scared of spiders, but a tarantula, considering they're poisonous, I prefer to stay away, to be honest. I have no interest of seeing, being in a room, or to be honest, even a tarantula touch me. Yeah, I have no interest in that. So anyway though, so I think that the idea that exposure therapy could be generalized and the effects could help other areas that you're not actually like targeted. For example, if you are targeting a fear of spiders, then you might have possible benefits for like a fear of heights. I think it's very interesting and does raise a very interesting question there are, because I know if you have complex conditions in mental health, for example, if someone has depression and eating disorder and anxiety, well, then like a part of the job though of a clinical psychologist is to determine which mental health condition that you actually treat first, because is the depression maintaining the eating disorder and the anxiety, or is it one of the others enabling and maintaining like the other two though? So I think it'd be interesting if we think about could different therapies that don't target a specific mental health condition, now could that have a benefit, and could that be generalised to other ones? For example, I know there are similarities between all methods of like CBT, so could CBT for depression be beneficial in reducing anxiety and maybe even eating disorder symptoms? So I think it's an interesting next step and just something really interesting to think about. So I hope you enjoyed the psychology news section. So let's move on to the person update. So moving on to the personal update. So this week's been very busy with a lot of like personal stuff. I guess in ready to like move out for the next academic year and a bunch of different things like that. And I definitely want to admit here that moving out and actually going into student accommodation actually in like Canterbury itself, well, it's definitely quite the learning experience though, because I mean like I've done living at home, I've done commuting, I've done living on a campus, but I've never lived in the typical student accommodation actually in like Canterbury, like actually in the city like itself. So I mean after this year, I mean I have literally covered all the bases, and like I'd probably be like some sort of like living at a university egg expert though, but I'm glad that that's coming along though. We basically finalised everything else in terms of like we've set up the bills, we've all spoken about room locations and just a whole bunch of other things like that though. So I'm definitely like looking forward to it, and I know it's going to be interesting for sure though. And then I've also been doing quite a lot of like other projects, including I'm actually doing this like quite interesting tweet. It's one of my research studies though. But before I actually talk about what the tweak is, because I think it's actually going to be quite useful for your understanding in case any of you are interested in like psychology research, let me just say one thing. If you were ever a psychology participant and you want a summary of the results when the data analysis is done, please mention the specific psychology study that you've done and the specific study that you actually want the results to, because so someone actually did one of my psychology studies. So they emailed my supervisor to request a summary of the results. Now my poor supervisor, I mean, she has my two studies. She has seven other master's students. Then she has FYP students, final year project students. So they're the undergrads. And I think she might be doing some of her own research. I doubt it, to be honest, because she's really, really busy at the moment. So that's probably at least 5-10 different psychology studies going on at the same time. So, yep. So she emailed it to me because she said, yeah, because she asked the participants, oh, what study, like, did you do, though? And then, like, she forwarded it to me, which still isn't that helpful because I have two studies on very similar topics, just to be honest, very, very different angles there. So my supervisor just said, sort this out, please. I think you'll be in a better position to do this. So I had to search like for it and everything like that. So thankfully though, I got it all like sorted. Well, sort of though. But the tweak that I actually wanted to do to my study, and I think this is useful to know for any psychology students, especially those that want to go into like a research zone, is that I thought that once your ethics application was done, it was very hard or it was very difficult to request an amendment. Because for my current psychology study, well, I have ethical permission to do data collection outside of my university, but I didn't tick the box or I didn't request ethical approval for collecting data outside of the United Kingdom. And I was talking to a PhD student, and her brother has recently become eligible for my psychology study, so we were talking about it. She said, oh, I'll show you your research with my brother, and he will probably be really willing to actually share it with other people within his like social networks, because he's really into the target population that I'm actually studying though. So it'd be interesting though. So because she's Irish, and so say, yeah, this would mean that the data collection is happening outside the like UK though. So I've emailed the like ethics board. Hopefully they will get back to me sooner rather than later, saying that yes, that's fine. Like just like tick this box or whatever. So basically, I'm hoping that the ethical amendment will be done like quite soon though, because then that will allow me to get even more participants. So a lot's happening, and I'm really looking forward to my last ever statistics lecture on Wednesday. That's going to be a lot of fun, because then I don't have to do statistics ever again. And then it's the revision for my exams in May, which I mean, I was doing my revision timetable last night. It's long, like there's a lot of revision to do. Especially because no one really understands it. Not because the lecture's bad, she's amazing. But I just mean, this is hard stuff. So it's interesting time for sure. So as always, I always love to know your thoughts and feelings on today's episode. So you can email me, connorwiley@connorwiley.net. You can always leave a comment at the show notes at connorwiley.net/podcast or tweet me on Twitter @SciFiWiley. I always love to hear from all of you because it really helps make the podcast feel more like a conversation. And today's episode has been sponsored by Formulation in Psychotherapy. So the reason why this book is the sponsor for today's episode is that because this is a really good in-depth look into a formulation in clinical psychology. So this book explains what is formulation. No, but also how is a formulation used in a wide range of different therapy settings. For example, CBT, psychodynamic, narrative therapy, and systemic therapy. as well as it also talks about the like criticisms and the social constructionist approach, which is actually a brilliant topic, and I love that topic. Like, it's definitely something I don't use often, but it's always good to be aware of it, because I think a lot of it's true, or a lot of it's just such interesting food for thought, though. And then it also talks about a wide range of other topics there. So I love this book. It's really useful and it's really interesting. So that is Formulation in Psychotherapy, available for all major ebook retailers. And you can order the paperback and the hardback version from Amazon, local bookstore or local library if you request it. So whilst buying books helps us support the creation and the editing of the podcast, my time is sponsored by my wonderful patrons. And if you wanted to become a patron and get tons of great rewards and to become part of a community, then now you can at patreon.com/psychologywordpodcast. So that's enough of the personality. Let's move on to the content part of today's episode. So moving on to the content part of today's episode, so we're going to be talking about what are the key elements of a clinical formulation report in psychotherapy. This is a great episode, I really enjoyed it, and let's just dive into it. What is a clinical formulation? So just so we're all on like the same page about formulation and what it actually in like those, I'm actually just like, going to read you a little egg extract from my book that sums it up really well. Open quote. In essence, formulation can be understood as a hypothesis to be tested. Ms. Butler, 1998, states that formulation is the tool used by clinicians to relate theory to practice. Nonetheless, that isn't the only definition of formulation, due to other notable figures in clinical psychology have made their own definitions as well. Open quote. A psychotherapy case formulation is essentially a hypothesis about the causes, propositions, and maintaining influences of a person's psychological, interpersonal, and behavioural problems. Close their quote. Elsa, 1997, page 4. Open quote. A change of ongoing collaborative sense making. Close a quote. Harper and Moss, 2003, page 8. I must mention that in the topic of formulation, there is one very important figure called Lucy Johnson, and she's a massive figure and a great author on the topic. So her definition does need to be highlighted. And just saying I love like Lucy Johnson's work, I think she's amazing. Open a quote. Formulation can be defined as the process of co-constructing a hypothesis or better guess about the origins of a person's difficulties in the context of their relationships, social circumstances, life events, and the sense that they make of them. It provides a structure for thinking together with the client or service user about how to understand their experiences and how to move forward. Formulation draws on two equally important sources of evidence. The clinician brings their knowledge derived from theory, research, and clinical experience, while the service user brings expertise about their own life and demeaning and the impact of their relationships and circumstances. Close quote, Johnson 2018. And personally, I flat out love formulation because I'm really excited that there is an option away from a diagnosis that allows us to tailor a course of a psychological therapy to a specific client and their needs. Since it really is all well and good us giving someone CBT, cognitive behavioural therapy, because they have depression, it's unless we tailor the CBT and make sure that it addresses what the client actually needs, then its effectiveness will be limited. And also, I do just want to take a moment to address the so-called criticisms of formulation, since the major criticism, and to be honest, I really don't have time for much of these like criticisms, because of course formulation is not perfect. I just think some of the so-called criticisms are just a bit silly and show a real lack of understanding about what formulation actually is. So, since the major criticism is about the idea that hypothesizing the formulation relies on isn't empirical in nature, or something along like those lines. And the reason why I think this is such a silly criticism is because if we follow this logic, then surely no experiment in any science is empirical, because all studies and all experiments start off with a hypothesis. Then an experiment is tested out and the results are assessed. The next steps are determined. This is exactly the same about what formulation seems to do, because a therapist works alongside a client to come up with a hypothesis based on sound psychological theory. Then they both test it out in a therapy, see what the results are, and then they tweak the formulation slash intervention plan, and they go again. This is no different from any type of empirical hypothesis testing. That is what formulation is. And I would talk about how formulation is different from a diagnosis, but I've done that in different places before and on other podcast episodes. Formulation questions. In addition, there are three main questions that a therapist seeks to answer when they write up their formulation about a client. What is causing the mental health difficulties? What factors are maintaining these difficulties? What might facilitate therapeutic change? What should a formulation report cover in clinical psychology? So, a formulation report should cover the following four areas for a client. Firstly, a therapist should summarise the client's mental health difficulties so that they can provide an overview of the difficulties the client is currently facing and identify which difficulties should be targeted in the therapy. Secondly, a formulation report should provide an evidence-based rationale for the proposed therapeutic approach. For example, if a therapist are wanting to offer a client internal family therapy, which there is a future podcast episode coming on, then the therapist would need to outline the theoretical basis for this therapy, explaining why would it be suitable for the client and the difficulties that they're experiencing. Thirdly, a formulation report should discuss a recommended treatment plan for the client, including their treatment measurements and diagnoses. Finally, the report should highlight issues that might come up in therapy. Since the report should explore the challenges that might pop up for the client in therapy, for example, any concerns about how a client might deal with some painful memories or feelings, or even the structure of the therapy itself. It's important to think about this now because it allows the therapist to come up with potential solutions ahead of time before the issue pops up. Overall, while this helps to improve the therapy experience for the client, therapy measurements and goals for success. As you can probably guess, an effective treatment plan for a client should include meaningful goals and measurements. Now, I know in clinical psychology, we use a lot of psychometric tests and measures, but as I talk about in clinical psychology reflections, Volume 4, this isn't always useful to our clients because it doesn't necessarily give them much motivation or goals opposed, because this is just a weird little number to them. Instead, working with a client to create meaningful goals helps them to make a progress and actually see that progress for themselves, hence why it's important to regularly review these goals with our clients. In addition, any ghost that should be a smart ghost, so that they need to be specific, measurable, achievable, realistic, and time-bound. Larger goals can and should be broken down into smaller steps or goals so the client is less overwhelmed. For example, your client might have a goal to build their emotional regulation and coping skills. Then the measurement for this goal might be identifying the negative thoughts and feelings when they pop up and then rating their strength. Afterwards, the client can review this goal by keeping a thought diary, and the therapist can review this diary with them each week in the session, as well as a rating scale of 1, being still not able to identify the negative feeling, to 5, meaning confident in recognizing the negative feelings, can be used to help the client to see that they're progressing. Conclusion. Personally, I still flat out love formulation because I hope that I've shown you that a comprehensive formulation can be powerful and a great tool for providing a therapist and a client with a solid basis for any psychological intervention. One that is based on psychological theory, evidence, and the client's expertise in their lived experiences. Due to, by grounding any therapeutic recommendations in evidence-based theory and considering the client's unique experience, we can build a flexible framework for therapy that is tailored to the client's needs, so that their goals and therapy outcomes can reflect their specific needs and their hope for the future. So I really hope that you enjoyed today's episode and you got something out of it. I know that I did because I love formulation. I love it. I love Lucy Johnson's work. I know I've got to look into it more. And to be honest, I really should do more podcast episodes on it because, I mean, like, formulation is just so helpful. You're working with a client. And sure, I know the practicalities of real psychological work doesn't always allow formulation to be as amazing as it is in theory, but formulation is still so critical. You're still helping a client, you're still working with them, you're still tailoring it to their needs because they're the one with the mental health difficulty, they're the ones that know why they've got it. So by working with them and just working with them to help us give them a better therapy, that's all of that clinical psychology should be striving for and beyond. So I think it's amazing. This is where we need to go. And to be honest, I know there's one NHS trust in the UK that actually does formulation at every single level of the trust and of the service, which I think is amazing. I really think formulation is just brilliant. So if you know anyone who would enjoy today's episode, then please share it with them. I'm always really grateful when you wonderful people help spread the word about the podcast. And if you want to learn more, definitely check out Formulation in Psychotherapy, available from all the usual places. And if you want to become a patron of the show, now you can. patreon.com/thepsychologyworld podcast. Or if you wanted to give me a bit of like one-time support as a thank you for the podcast, then you can buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/Con Wiley. So have a great day, everyone, and I'll see you next time. Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. Please remember to like the video and subscribe to the YouTube channel and follow the podcast on your favourite podcast app. And if you wanted to learn more, then please check out the backlist of the podcast episodes or my books at conwiley.net. So have a great day and I'll see you next time.